Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, December 30th, 2002. Today's session is Peace is the Way, Session 2, Peace with Self. An acknowledgement of wounds and weakness and recognizing steps toward wholeness. Presented by Joyce Holiday and Mary Emily Wells. Let's listen in.
Before the break, for those of you who were out meeting or doing something fun rather than being with us, we focused on peace with God, and we're hoping that there will be a sense of continuity as we move through some of this. So this session is on peace with self, and I guess I do need to say this is the one we probably struggled over the most, and Emily was saying the other day when we were talking about this that there's even something that feels a little bad about the idea of peace with self, in the sense that, you know, there's so much going on that's wrong in the world, and is it even okay to just, you know, it sort of carries these overtones of escapist kind of things, and that whole idea, I think, has been abused in a way to, you know, as long as you're at peace with yourself, there's not much else you need to do. That's not the approach that we're going to take, and that's part of, you know, putting it into this continuum that is leading us toward the idea of peace in the world. So we're going to, as we did this morning, just share a few things out of our own experience and out of the poetry, and hope that will spark some discussion and hope that it sort of connects more or less on this one. I want to start by reading the 139th Psalm, which is actually my favorite psalm, and just to kind of do this in a sort of meditative way to get us a little quiet and centered on our topic. Begin. Oh God, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You discern my thoughts from far away. You search out my path and my lying down and are acquainted with all my ways. Even before a word is on my tongue, O God, you know it completely. You hem me in behind and before and lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is so high that I cannot attain it. Where can I go from your spirit? Or where can I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and settle at the farthest limits of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me, and your right hand shall hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, and the light around me become night, even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is as bright as the day, for darkness is as light to you. For it was you who formed my inward parts. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works, that I know very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was being made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of the earth. Your eyes beheld my unformed substance. In your book were written all the days that were formed for me, when none of them as yet existed. How weighty to me are your thoughts, O God. How vast is the sum of them. I try to count them. They are more than the sand. I come to the end. I am still with you. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my thoughts. See if there is any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. Amen. I think there's a particular connection between peace with God and peace with self that begins at the point of recognizing that we have all been created in the image of God, and that much of the violence and lack of peace in the world comes when that sense gets violated, that there are some people in the world who are less than those of us who have been created in the image of God. And of course, we hear lots of rhetoric as we're going off to war now, as we have in the past, of God being on our side and this being God's cause as we go about doing the violence that we tend to do in the world. I want to share a dream with you that I had, over 10 years ago now. I had been at with Sojourners Community for about 15 years, and it became necessary for me to leave. And at the time that I left, it was really, in a sense, a loss of my entire life, because I lost a marriage, I lost my community, I lost my church, I lost my work, I lost my home. And the decision to leave and kind of start a new life was a very scary one for me, because I think I was wrestling with this question: is there life for me beyond Sojourners? And I landed in the mountains of Western North Carolina, very broken, as broken as I have ever been in my life, and also feeling a lot of guilt over my inability to reconcile not just the brokenness within me, but the brokenness in the relationships that led to my having to leave the community. And the very first night that I was in North Carolina, I had this dream. And the dream started, I was standing in a room which had these bright white walls, and it was just absolutely flooded with light. There were windows all around. And there was a couple, a man and a woman, who were standing in one corner. And the man approached me, and he was holding in his arms a kind of sack of the sort that, you know, might have grain in it or seeds or something. And he walked up to me and he said, "Joyce, will you carry this sack across the river for us?" Well, I didn't know where the river was. I didn't know what was in the sack. But he put the sack into my arms, and I found myself walking out of this room, headed to try to find the river. And I discovered when I walked out of the room that it was perched on the edge of this sheer cliff. And there was a river way down below going through a gorge. But the only path was a very, very narrow path that went up the side of this cliff. So I started out carrying this sack going up the side of the cliff, and I got to the top, and there was the river was at the top, and it went and it, you know, plunged down with this huge waterfall into the gorge, and there were some stepping stones, and so I decided that I needed to carry this sack across these stepping stones. Well, I got about halfway across the river, and it became very precarious, and the stones started to move a little bit, and I realized that unless I dropped the sack, I was going to lose my balance and fall down into the gorge. And so I dropped the sack and watched it plunge down into the water and turned around and just felt terrible. I was rehearsing my apology the whole way. I was going back to this room to tell the couple that I dropped the sack. And I get back in the room, and before I could even begin to apologize, the woman came forward, and she was holding this bowl, huge bowl, pottery, handmade, full of these glazes with aqua and burgundy and gold through it. And I mean, clearly a work of art. And she said to me, "Joyce, will you carry this bowl across the river for us?" And I kind of tried to let her know that that didn't seem like a real good idea. Dropped the sack. But again, I wasn't even able to protest before she handed the bowl into my arms. And I went out of the room and I started up the path again. And the same thing happened. I got about halfway out in the river and I realized that the only way to keep from falling was to drop the bowl. And I watch it just smashing on the rocks as it falls down into the river. And came back and, you know, was feeling twice the guilt, but also anger, because, you know, they should have known that I couldn't carry the bowl across because I dropped the sack. And, you know, so I'm rehearsing all again what I'm going to say to them when I get back to the room. And again, they don't really let me speak. And the two of them come toward me as soon as they get back in the room. And the man has something wrapped up in a blanket, and he brings it forward to me, and he says, "Joyce, will you carry our baby across the river for us?" And I started to protest, but you know, they wouldn't listen, and the dream ended with him handing the baby into my arms and me walking out the door of the room onto the path with the baby. Hmm. Well, I was like really disturbed by this dream for a long time. I felt like I was practically haunted by it, you know, because and I was trying to, I spent most of my time trying to figure out who the baby was. I mean, that seemed like sort of the key to the whole thing. And I'd actually been handed a baby once when I was in Nicaragua from a mother who asked if I would take her child back to the United States. This was when the war was raging in Nicaragua, and she wanted her child taken to a place where there was no war. And, you know, I thought of children in the neighborhood I was living in who were, you know, at 6 and 7 years old, wearing these beepers for the drug dealers because they would use the kids to run the drugs. And I thought of the babies and the children I had seen in the squatter camps in South Africa. And so I was kind of, you know, obsessing for a while on what's the significance of the child. And then finally, I remembered a woman who I had met, a woman named Gloria. I had participated with, I think there were about 60 of us, from Sojourners and others in Washington, D.C., participated in a protest against a nuclear arms exhibition that used to come to D.C. every year in the fall, in which we used to call the Arms Bazaar, because it was literally like these sellers of nuclear weapons would come and set up in the Sheraton Washington hotels, and you know, merchants, mostly from the developing world, would come to the hotel and literally purchase these nuclear weapons. And it was all, and it was all sort of in the spirit of a county fair or something, you know, and they gave out pens and tie clips in the shape of nuclear missiles and had these scantily clad models talking about nuclear capabilities. And I mean, it was just as offensive a thing as there could be. And so we began organizing at Sojourners and with some other groups to oppose this exhibition every year. And so one of the first years, a group of about 60 of us carried bread up the driveway of the hotel on the night that there was this very elegant banquet going on inside. And, you know, all the military people came in their dress whites and the women in their gowns. And, you know, here we are in the driveway. We had a sign that said, "Bread, not bombs." Because, you know, the Pentagon was absolutely bloated and the neighborhood that we lived in was full of children who were starving. And we, of course, got arrested in our sense of pride about all this was a little deflated when we learned that the charge, that the thing you're charged with when you block a driveway in Washington, D.C. is called incommoding. So we all had this charge of incommoding, and they put us in the police wagons and they took us to the courthouse where there was some cells, and we were to stay there before our trial, our arraignment the next day. And there was a cell where all of those of us who were women who had participated in it were put, and then, you know, another one for the men. And then in the cell across from us women was another cell for all the other women who were not protesters who were being arrested that night. Almost all of whom had been arrested for prostitution, and in fact they had done a raid on a big house of prostitution in the city, and Gloria was among those who were put into that cell. And we weren't that far apart from each other, so we got into some conversation, and Gloria and I had what is probably the most important theological conversation of my life, because she began talking to me about the grace of God. And at that time in my life, in contrast to the time of the dream, this would have been probably 10 years before, I wasn't really able to receive it in a way that made sense in my life. I mean, it was really about, you know, she was talking about she had a drug addiction and she was prostituting herself as a way of getting money to deal with the drug addiction, but also she had a son and she was trying to get money so she could buy food for her young son. And she began to talk about this arrest being a really good thing because it was going to kind of wake her up, and it was God's way of giving her a second chance. And she talked about, you know, God always gives us second chances and third and fourth, and how real that was in her life and how foreign it felt to my life, because at that time I felt like somebody who pretty much was going to get through life on my own power and my own gifts and my own strength, or at least that's what I perceived about myself at the time. I talked with Gloria that night until about 3 o'clock in the morning, and it really was totally about how the grace of God was transforming her life. And we then decided that we ought to try to get a little bit of sleep, and you know, so we're in this on this hard concrete floor, and I popped out my contact lenses, and I was holding, you know, one in each hand and trying to get a little sleep. And before long, people began to sing, the people in our cell, and people were sort of waking up, and I forgot a piece of the story. There was a woman who was brought into the cell across from us while Gloria and I were still having conversation, and this woman asked Gloria, well, what are they in for? You know, looked at our cell and thought that largely because we were white and because the DC jail system was really intended to incarcerate people of color, wanted to know what we had done. And I heard Gloria say, they incommoded. And the woman started laughing, and then Gloria said, at a hotel. So the whole incommoding thing had become this big deal in the cell. And people began singing in the morning, and I decided that it'd be a good idea for me to put my contact lenses back in. Well, I'm legally blind without my contact lenses, and so I groped my way toward this contraption in the cell that is the toilet and the sink and the drinking fountain, and went to get some water to, you know, put my lenses under and put them back in. And, you know, accidentally hit what was the thing to flush the toilet, which in a jail toilet, I don't know if you ever heard one, but it's like an avalanche would sound out here. I think, you know, just this huge whoosh, and Gloria yells over top of the flushing toilet, now that's incommoding. And then she said, does anybody know Amazing Grace? And so the singing turned to singing Amazing Grace. And I just was aware of the look on Gloria's face as she was singing Amazing Grace. And this guard came to try to shut us up, basically, because he was disturbed by the singing. And I think in particularly the kind of, you know, it was very momentary, but a kind of solidarity that it was happening between all of us women down there. And he came up and he asked, what's going on here? What's this all about or something? And Gloria stuck her head right up to the bars and looked the guard in the face and said to him, it's only the gospel. And I was really struck with the reality that that amazing grace is at the heart of the gospel. Now, I know this isn't good news for Lutherans to hear. People have been telling me, oh, we'll have a conversation about works righteousness before this is all over. And I'm as heavy into works righteousness or have been in my life as anybody I know. But I think for me, the recollection of that conversation with Gloria and the dream made me realize that it really is about the grace of God, and I needed the kind of brokenness in my life, in my spirit, for that grace to really break in to me. And finally realized that the message of the dream was about the fact that it didn't matter how much we fall or fail, but I was being entrusted with ever more valuable gifts, including the very gift of life itself as represented by this baby, and that I was having my life handed back to me in a whole new context, in a very scary context, and having to recreate it all. But this time around, it was really going to be through my understanding of the grace of God. You know, it had always been about the grace of God, but I was not in a place to recognize it. And the dream opened me up to be able to forgive myself, forgive others for the brokenness that I had left behind, and to really begin to heal. And it's really important for me in a group to tell this, I think, because my life had been so much about the activism and trying to make change here and stop the war in Central America, stop nuclear weapons, and stop apartheid in South Africa. And, you know, it was really all about what could we do, how could we make change. And I needed to learn the lesson in a very direct and dramatic way about the reality of the grace of God. And I think I offer that as a way of saying that I think that's where peace with self begins, is recognizing how rooted it is in peace with God, in our being created in the image of God, and in our capacity to receive the grace of God.
Thanks for sharing that.
As I did this morning, I'm going to read two shorter poems, which take a slightly different look at how we would come to peace with ourselves. First one talks more about. I'll just read it. Let's introduce it. This is again by Denise Levertov. It's called The Avowal. As swimmers dare to lie face to the sky, and water bears them, as hawks rest upon air and air sustains them, so would I learn to attain free fall and float into Creator Spirit's deep embrace, knowing no effort earns that all-surrounding grace. I'll read it one more time. As swimmers dare to lie face to the sky and water bears them, as hawks rest upon air and air sustains them, so would I learn to attain free fall and float into Creator Spirit's deep embrace, knowing no effort earns that all-surrounding grace. Any first reactions to that?
It speaks about grace, but the word it doesn't say is faith. Mm. As swimmers dare, as swimmers have faith that they're not going to drown. Mm-hmm. The hawk has a faith that it's going to be alive. Mm-hmm. We have to have a faith in order to accept the grace of God. Mm-hmm.
Trust that it'll be there.
The last line really struck me, just like that no effort, like it's not something necessarily. For me, the way it struck it is that I think I tend to strive too much almost for mm-hmm. the grace or the peace. And I don't know a lot about Buddhism, but some of them talking with my friends as far as like with meditating, it's like just trying to be. And I think that that's something that for me, that's very peaceful. And like thinking of that, it's a hard concept for me, but when it happens, it's incredible. And kind of like, it's almost like the harder you try for it, the farther away it gets. But when you just sit down and, you know, allow yourself to be, it can come more readily.
Mm-hmm. Kind of a atmosphere or situation do you see the person in? I mean, is this, what kind of a situation is a person in who can dare to speak this poem? What's going on around? Maybe not much. That's kind of how I read it. Not much is going on around. It's sort of a removed, the water, you get the image of the water and the air and this embrace, they're all sort of, they're clean slates, you know? Sort of a void a person could exist in. Let's compare that to the next one. The title of this is February 2nd, 1968. Anybody remember what happened towards the end of January in 1968? January 30th was the Tet Offensive, part of the Vietnam War. February 2nd, all I can think of for that is, I think it's Groundhog Day.
Yeah.
So it's sort of a turning point, maybe, you could say. So interesting date to have chosen. Maybe it's just the day he wrote it, but.
Is it Candlemas as well?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So keep that in mind. In the dark of the moon, in flying snow, in the dead of winter, war spreading, families dying, the world in danger, I walk the rocky hillside sowing clover. In the dark of the moon, in flying snow, in the dead of winter, war spreading, families dying, the world in danger, I walk the rocky hillside sowing clover.
In contrast to the last one where maybe not much has happened, there's a lot happening in the world, but this person still seems pretty moved. If they're walking around selling clover, then all these other things are happening.
Mm-hmm. You said you see the person seems removed?
Yeah.
Still.
Not involved in the other things that are happening.
Mm-hmm. Although, could it be that with all that other stuff going on, the most important thing one could do is sow clover? Mm-hmm.
Does anybody know what clover does?
Mm-hmm. It's a ground, it's a cover crop, I know, for adding to the soil and giving it life so that you can grow in the spring.
Yeah.
It adds a lot to the nitrogen.
Nitrogen fixing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an act of hope.
That's what I saw. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I saw it as, despite everything that's going on, it's planting a life that will grow and something that will add to the soil and end up giving back.
It's also a little deranged. I mean, it's not when you're so cold.
Yeah.
You also clever in
February.
Right.
It smells.
On rocky ground.
Oh. Rocky ground.
Is it a little bit like, too, is it like thinking globally, acting locally? Like doing what you can, like where you are, right where you are,
yeah.
Doing what you can to like.
But it seems as a,
promote
it's
growth,
like an act of
change.
Of, it's an act of hope in the midst of, in a despairing situation. I mean, a situation of despair, you do something hopeful. But it's a little.
Not necessarily something rational.
Yeah,
it's irrational. So when would one sow clover in Oregon, which is where Stafford lives?
This is Wendell Berry.
Wendell Berry.
He's from
back east.
Kentucky.
Yeah. So he's not into the dead of winter like we see it.
Right. Still not till March.
Still not till March.
I live in Kentucky.
You still live in February.
Don't push it.
I get snow.
Yeah.
So it's a little foolish. Rocky ground in February. Mm-hmm.
It's an act a lot like Jeremiah when his world is falling apart all around him. He buys a tract of land, even though he and all of his people are going to be sent off to Babylon soon. He buys a tract of land anyway as an irrational act of hope.
Well, it's sort of like standing in a driveway with bread, isn't it?
Standing or Roger?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, but it does something for you, you know? It does something for the world somehow. I mean, it gets you this interaction with these other inmates and you know, gives you something to kind of hold on to.
I think most acts of hope are irrational. I mean, that's part of
yeah.
The hope. It all makes sense.
Hope
is that hope fear.
Yeah, hope
is fear.
You wouldn't really need hope.
If it all made sense.
Yeah.
I know, I kind of think of it as being maybe the most rational thing that you can do. I think what's irrational is what's going on. what's irrational is the war that's happening all the time. I think it is rational that we're planting life, we're planting, we're doing things, this is peaceful, what we're doing, that's rational.
Mm-hmm. But it's not huge. I mean, it's not world scale. Mm-hmm. Which is, I think that's sort of the challenge for me, peace with myself. Like Joyce was saying, we were talking last night, sometimes I feel like I really should not have peace with myself. There are things so wrong in the world, so unjust. There's no way I should be even comfortable with myself and the life I have and the things I do and the choice. There's no way I should even, I mean, I should be so frustrated with myself I shouldn't even get out of bed in the morning. That's totally a hopeless thing to say, but I feel that sometimes. That's why this topic is hard for me. Because I don't think I should have peace with myself. It's a challenge for me every day to remind myself that it's an okay thing and necessary. It is rational. You know, it's like putting the paperclip on. I don't know how many of you know that tradition of putting a paperclip on every morning as a symbol of peace. I think it started in Poland during
Norway.
During Nazi
occupation.
Yeah.
As a symbol of what?
As a symbol of peace. The community of St. Janet can maybe talk more about that.
Martin and Teresa.
Community of St. Martin
and Teresa took it from the Norwegian children who, during the occupation, would put paper clips on as a sign of protest, that we were peacemakers, were called the peacemakers, and they would be taken away from them, but they could always find another one, so the next day they'd come back with another. So it was a child's sign of protest. Mm-hmm. And so this little group of people who, St. Martin and as part of an order, St. Martin and Teresa, took that as a discipline to wear, say, each day, put a paper clip on and say, I'm called to be a peacemaker today.
But it's that need to get up in the morning and reestablish that sense of hope, which you can easily lose sight of with other ways and the problems that we deal with.
There's something about that last month off the rocky soil that gets me. I mean, it's a hopeful sign, but I grew up on a farm, and you don't plant in rocky soil. Mm-hmm. So I mean that just maybe the persistence of hopefulness. Mm-hmm. On the other side of it, you could say, well, the rocky ground is maybe a little more stable. Mm-hmm. It's grounded.
Or the chance of something coming out of sowing clover is always going to be greater than what's going to come out of war. But maybe it's that kind of contrast. Mm-hmm. That small chance is always going to be a better outcome than the contrast.
Mm-hmm. Well, and isn't the rocky soil sort of a symbol for, the things that are going on in the world, the winter, the war?
Mm-hmm. Right, which would fit the same.
And even the rockiest field, like the one in front of the chalet where there we cleared rocks and planted grass on it, and it's now grassy. I remember looking at that in despair with two people I was assigned to clear it with, just thinking, there's no way to clear the rocks. And after a whole day of talking and being on our backs in this field that was just gravel to me, became the place where we laid down seed and grew up.
That's so interesting. Yeah.
And even it looked so hopeless. I'm like, the novice horticulture is looking at it, going, oh, whatever, that will not be grass. but it was the end of the season. And
same thing with the tailings. I mean, I was walking up to the hydro yesterday, just kind of looking out over the tailings, which I spent a bunch of time, like 2 or 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. One spring, putting compost in there and getting 1,000 trees from the Forest Service. And I've never been back to see if anything's happened. And there's some trees there. It's like totally wild. And the middle of the tail end of it today.
Well, that image of planting the seed in such, a dire situation, where there seemed to be such you know, sense of frustration that, you know, the thing is, the planting the seed brings the peace to the individual planting it, to the self, that at least, you know, I'm conscious of the situation and you know, that you're, even if it's not going to do any good, standing in the line, you know, and blocking the area with the bread, that has to be a very frustrating, you know, situation, I would imagine, because you wonder, it comes to the thought, well, what good is it, you know, really going to do in the end? But then it's, well, at least this is what I'm doing. Right. This is what I need to do. Whether, you know, whatever's going to come out of it, you kind of let go of that and leave that into God's hands.
Ammon Hennessy used to protest out at the Nevada nuclear weapons test site. And he began back in the 40s when the whole nuclear program began. And he used to, you know, stand out there at the edge of the test site with a sign, you know, protesting the testing that was going on. And, you know, people used to come by and jeer at him, and yeah. I've been out there protesting. I know how that feels. You know, the workers would come in the morning and, you know, make comments as you're there. And he would do it all by himself. And, you know, finally somebody came up to him and said, well, you know, you're never going to change anything standing out here with this sign. And he said, well, I may not change them, but I'm doing this so that they won't change me. And I think it's important to keep that in mind, too. Part of it is hanging on to what the self is, you know, and if we're going to claim to be a nonviolent, peaceful self to the best of our ability to do that, then we need to keep reminding ourselves of that and putting ourselves in situations where we claim over and over again that whatever the powers that be are up to, whether it's war or bombs or, you know, whatever, that we're not going to allow that to change
I love, too, the sense, Mary Ellen talked about that, you know, maybe we shouldn't have a peace with ourselves and our places of privilege, and then combine that just with your image of being in the jail, like that by trying to work for change in this world, we can, as people with privilege, be brought to a place of poverty, of helplessness, and there to meet face grace face to face, that in many ways is a good beginning point for us to begin to hear the gospel as the poor do. Mm-hmm.
Perhaps it's also a conscious awareness of how, as an individual in our society, part of that system, how we are, you know, really a part of it. You know, we're oil consumers. You know, we don't think about it. You know, day to day. You know, we're just in. You know, we're used to our lifestyle, and we do what we can to support that. You know, but and we can often be unaware of the harm that it's doing to others, and just. You know, being conscious of that, I think, and then coming to, you know, peace with yourself in the sense of making little changes in your own life. Drinking, you know, fairly traded coffee, you know, is a very little step, but it's a sense of this is a good thing that we're doing, you know. Mm-hmm. And it builds a sense of hope. Feeding that that inner peace.
I'd like to go back again to the concept of grace, and I'd like to know whether that's easier for the rest of you than it is for me, or how you've experienced that in your life, where that has really broken into your life. Do you struggle with it?
Hard
think of grace as a gift that comes to us most often when we're not expecting it. And maybe that ties in a little with that first poem that you read. Not expecting it, not making an effort for it. The water is simply there, the air is simply there. And a story that, my own story that I replay in my head when I think of grace, comes from, I guess when I was here on staff 5 years ago, and it was a prayer around the cross, and it was a service when we were not to leave anyone kneeling around the cross without approaching them and putting a hand on the shoulder or an arm around the shoulders. And so I was kneeling beside the cross, and it took a few moments before anyone appeared. And I knew someone would come, and when someone did come, was this tiny little hand that barely weighted on my shoulder. And I don't know, I may have even told this before in the past when I've been here. Maybe Janet, maybe it's ringing a bell, yeah. And so after sitting for a while and just appreciating that tiny little warm presence, I turned around and it was Johanna Gilia when she was, you know, about this big. And there was her just tiny little hand. That tiny little hand, for me, has been the huge definition of grace. In the past 5 years, it was 5 years ago. So that was an unexpected gift that came in a tiny little package.
I like thinking of grace like water and like air, because it's something that we need so bad. For life, we just die without it. We like wither up spiritually, mentally, emotionally without it. And if we don't, and most often for me, my experience has been not of the absence of grace, but in the absence or my own disconnect from it, not believing it, not seeing it, not trusting that people will be gracious with me, and being pleasantly surprised after much prodding to believe, you know, that it's there, and growing in my understanding of, like, God's grace has been given to all of us, and the more that we accept it, the more we can give it. We've all heard that, you know. And for me, that's been really hard. Actually, is like believing that I not just am forgiven, but I'm okay. That I'm okay today. Jeff and I would talk about this for hours at night when I was here. And I struggled with it. I was judgmental of other people and always very focused on the truth. Okay, and I truly believe we have to have truth and grace together. But I was missing, I hadn't experienced grace in my family that much. And it was very hard for me to give it. And it was only in leaving here that I became in touch with that and realized that and grew and started to process that and to experience grace and become, I think, more gracious. But it's been painful, actually. Which sounds weird that grace is supposed to be this wonderful thing to receive. And but it's been hard. So I'm very thankful. We do need it, like water and like air. It was really spiritual. I was kind of dying because I was just struggling and working and just feeling like I wasn't connecting with God. It's so hard. And all that effort didn't work because I wasn't connecting with the whole of God. And grace is a big part of that.
think the form of grace that I've encountered most recently is the knowledge that I can be as angry and frustrated and almost feeling violent towards God. I can be as angry as I want to be or need to be, and it's not gonna diminish God. Like, my questions, my doubts, and my accusations aren't gonna somehow make God go away. I was standing in my room, this is really embarrassing. I was standing in my dorm room earlier this fall. I was having a really bad fall. So anyway, my roommate's gone. It's dark outside and dark in my room, so I can sort of see out the window. It's this enormous window. I'm standing there just yelling at the top of my lungs. I was so furious, mostly about the idea of this war coming. So furious. How could you do this? And feeling like I was totally useless. Because I sit around, you know, praying for God to give me direction, and, you know, I say, I'd like to be your servant, but you just have to tell me what it is you want me to do. You can't just be a little more clear with me, because if you're just being sort of vague and I'm not picking it up, God, so talk to me. So I'm just sitting there yelling and yelling and yelling and crying, stomping my feet and throwing things. It was really embarrassing. And in the end, what I was most mad about is I felt like God wasn't there. You know, I was feeling so hurt and lonely in my faith that I thought, you know, I feel like God's abandoned me. I'm not being given a task. I'm not being helped through this. Then I realized in the end that the fact that I could stand there and yell at the top of my lungs and not be afraid that that was going to somehow diminish God, that in itself was God's grace. I can't do anything to make God go away, you know. That's my most recent encounter.
I had a dream the other night that was similar to that, after a day of similar behavior, while trying to rehabilitate a cabin that has adopted me. And in the dream, I was continuing on with all this real embarrassing stuff. And at a certain point, I realized I wasn't alone in the room. And I guess I felt it was God that was, and that I was really in trouble because I was condemning one of the classic pieces that popped out of my mouth during the behavior earlier in the day was, "Goddamn all deities," which kind of is how ridiculous it gets to when I start getting to the point of being angry. At any rate, this other in the room, when I went over face to face, was of course me, and and that me wasn't the least bit angry. It was just watching and kind of just made an opening gesture, like, and then just kind of touched my shoulder, and it felt real surprising. And encouraging, and it felt like that upon waking up, the emotion was a pretty good feeling. You know, it was a feeling. I guess it was a feeling of unconditional love. Was that I could do that, and I was thinking when someone was talking here a little bit in our first session about how, when he was talking up there and looking down, I was thinking, I was wanting the answer, but it was kind of awkward. and how a lot of the time my growing up has been that type of discussion with God, where it's just that it's kind of been so awkward with this type of thing. Mm-hmm. But this thing of seeing God, you on the same plane, and that God is in each individual, and that God may be presenting to me best through me. I found it an encouraging dream. Both that God was accessible and pretty compassionate about how hard I am on God.
Mm-hmm. And not just accessible, but that's what you're sharing sort of takes me back to the song of we can't escape God even if we want to. You know, we can't. Where can I flee from God's Spirit if I go to heaven? If I go to Sheol, if I go to the uttermost parts of the sea, you know, if I go to the highest mountain, whatever. God is going to be there, you know, which is, I think, takes me back kind of full circle to being able to be at peace with this idea of peace with self, as long as I realize that, you know, essentially, it's really the same to me as peace with God. You know, it's sort of the peace with the God, the part of God that is within me, you know, the part of the image of God that resides in me, and the openness to receive the unconditional love, the openness to receive the grace. And I appreciate, Sonia, what you were saying about the struggle, because I think a lot of us are there, and I think that's, you know, what it was about for me, or the struggle to accept the unconditional love.
I think
we feel unworthy of
it. One of the things that comes to mind, I think it's sad in our culture that there. What I'm beginning to understand more about people is that people really do. This is actually something I've learned a little bit from Mary. Is that people do long to please. They long to be in relationships where they are doing what's right. But in terms of this peace issue, for example, or even in the church, right, as a pastor, oftentimes pastors block people's opportunities to serve because, you know, because there's a sense that you have to get it right or you have to think right or something like that. And I think all of us, we struggle a little bit here, but if all of a sudden, you know, the fire alarm went off and we had to like risk our lives for somebody. Just about everybody in the room would do it. Mm-hmm. And that's not true maybe across the board, across the culture. There might be some people who say, look, I'm just not gonna. But what I'm struck by is our willingness ultimately to serve, but oftentimes it's hard to find those places in our culture where we can actually do the work. Where we can segue into the work, where we can learn the skills that would allow us to give up. We have this whole barrage of advertising and cultural norms that push us to gather. I mean, just watching a little bit of television makes you wonder, well, maybe I am. I'm not as cute as I could be if I have surgery or, you know, something. And maybe it would be nice to have some more money. You know, the culture is constantly pushing us in this other direction. I found, for example, my uncle took care of my grandmother. My uncle never married. My uncle never married and ended up being the son who took care of his mother. And last January 1st, my mother broke her hip. She was in a convalescent home for a few weeks. And then the issue was, is she going to come to Alaska and live with Jeff, or is she going into a convalescent home for good? And so, you know, I'm like, okay. Took that whole thing on, and it's very interesting because it's not an easy thing to do to take care of your parent kind of full time, you know, she's always there. But on the other hand, it has these wonderful, the fear that I had of that, sort of like the fear that everyone has of giving up or taking on something hard, is rewarded by the grace of this new sense of what you can do in the world. I mean, you can do these things. If only the world provided us more opportunities to be responsible for each other and to be able to move in directions so that we're not just standing in the driveway holding bread so that somebody gets the... But that the whole town is kind of working toward peace, that there are ways that we can all be engaged in working toward peace. Is it possible to have a world where there are more opportunities to do that in the course of a... So it's not countercultural, but it's cultural. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. For me, I recently really experience God's grace. I've been going through a breakup with someone I was with for over 4 years, and very shortly after we broke up, he had already moved on, and we started going to this church together, and so I always kind of saw it as our church, and it made it even harder because that was kind of a community that knew us as us. And he hadn't been since he moved out, and then it was on a Sunday evening, and I went to church, and he was there with the woman that he had moved on with, and that was so incredibly tough. And my pastor asked, so how are we going to deal with this? You know, are you going to stay? And I'm like, yeah, I'm staying. In the midst of all of that, the only thing that could keep me going during the service was saying, okay, God, I don't want to think about this. You know, I've just got to focus. And it gave me this intenseness of focus on the sermon that I've never had before in my life. Seriously, I don't know if I'll ever experience it again. It was like the sermon was written for me, and it was like I was the one meant to hear it, and it just entered me, and it was like it was written for me, and I was in the sermon, and that was definitely God's grace. I mean, because all throughout all of this experience, I've just been like, where is God? What does God want for my life? And it was, you know, that through that situation that for me was just awful, God was able to work, and it was just incredible. You know, it turned like a horrible situation into something that gave me meaning.
My watch says it's about 3:40, so it's almost lunchtime. Anything, particularly anybody who hasn't shared anything, got anything burning in their hearts that you'd like to offer before we close this session?
I guess I've been having, thoughts haven't been leaping to mind. The only thing that comes to mind about grace and peace itself is, minutia in my mind, that I have this quote that I can't remember fully, nor can I remember who said it, but it goes something to the effect of, do good in the particulars, general good is the cry of the cad and the charlatan. And I really do believe that. It seems so obvious, and I think people have said it in several ways, but I can't imagine anything more true for myself, that There's nothing that should not be started at the ground, you know, that shouldn't be started with the seeds being sown, although I'm not sure I'd throw my seeds on rocky soil. You know, when I lived in the Quaker community, I felt that setting the dinner table was a really, we discussed whether it was truly prayer, but really something that you do on a repetitive basis day after day, as an offering to the greater good, felt like a prayer, but it was just a very minute act, and I find that taking my dog for a walk, repetitive actions, being kind to people. I once went through the door of the post office, and a man held open the door for me, and I said, thank you, and he said, oh, I thank you for saying thank you. And, you know, it just seems like really there's nothing but starting at that level. I mean, all things are created, you know, great visions can go beyond that, and there's no reason not to have hope for great things, but that really the greatest good for me, which I think is also peace and a sense of rightness, is begun at the very smallest level and repeated, perhaps.
That sounds like a good note to end on. Thank you, Mary. Thank you very much.